The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. Last week we discussed life, death, the universe, and, well, everything really. So today we're restricting ourselves to the sick room. We'll meet up with the poet Sarah Manguzzo, who has written hauntingly about her experience of years of illness. But we bring cheerful news as well.
If the reading therapy can be as effective as we believe it can, then not only will the arts be shown as central to the well-being of human beings, but they will also be cost-effective. And that's to say, poetry, not Prozac.
Now there's a rallying cry for this podcast, if ever there was one. We'll have more on that later. With me in the studio are Robert McCrum, who's written about his own recovery after a stroke, and Sarah Crown, editor of our book's website. Welcome back, both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
So let's begin with the poet Sarah Manguzzo, who has changed tack and written a memoir of 9 years of illness, entitled Two Kinds of Decay. It's a powerful, sparsely written account of a serious disease that struck her in her first year at university. She describes how it felt to our own Sarah Crown.
I woke up one morning and my feet were asleep, and so, like any rational person, I thought I must have slept on them wrong or not slept long. You know, I had all of these sort of increasingly irrational explanations for this fairly odd symptom. I was tired, I had a cold, I had worn shoes that were too tight. Within a couple of days of that symptom, I started having a lot of trouble washing my face because I wasn't able to hold my breath for the couple of seconds that it would take to splash water on my face. And that was slightly more alarming, but still nothing to truly panic about. And after about a week, the numbness had started spreading up my legs, had started affecting my trunk and my hands. There were spots of numbness in my face. I was beginning to have trouble walking because the disease was hampering not just my sensation, but my strength. My motor neurons were affected.
And this is the point at which you thought?
I had no real desire to go to a doctor or go to the hospital, but when I started falling down, I thought, well, I must have a brain tumor. This is it. So I had my mother actually come to school, went to the emergency department and was diagnosed after about half an hour, and there it began. It was very quick. Mm. I have no idea. It was just a stroke of luck that the neurologist on call was fairly old, fairly experienced, and had seen similar diseases before.
In the book, you go through the treatments that you received for this illness, which sound far more horrifying, really, when you're reading it, than the initial diagnosis of the illness does, you know, this numbness. The main one that I remember from reading the book is this process called aphoresis, I think.
Aphoresis was probably the most medieval treatment that I had. And so the blood is actually removed from the body, either one cup at a time or continuously through a tube, and then centrifuged. It then separates into its components, and so depending on which component of your blood is ill, in my case it was the plasma, it's thrown away, replaced sort of with some attempt at an artificial substitute for it, and then replaced in the body. And like dialysis, it can be very exhausting, it can just feel very uncomfortable. For the first year or so that I was receiving it, the machine at my hospital didn't have a blood warmer, and so my blood was going back into me at room temperature. It feels cold. And so, yeah, there were many odd, strange, unpleasant sensations I'd never felt before.
And so you went from being a sort of healthy college student, sort of working, playing, enjoying yourself, as people at university do, as any 21-year-old going
through
that
adventures,
experience.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Would do, to being somebody who was bedridden in hospital, in and out of hospital, having your blood cleaned by a machine. Mm-hmm. That must have been shocking.
It was so shocking that my awareness, I think, didn't really catch up with the immediate experience for a while. I remember feeling in my own imagination, I was the 21-year-old hero of my own narrative. And so I practiced being heroic. I cracked jokes. I just acted as bravely as I thought I should. And after about a year, I had started to get used to the possibility that I might not ever walk properly again. That's when the real paradigm adjustment occurred.
And you talk in the book about, you mentioned depression, but one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was that my experience of reading the book is different actually from the experience of sitting down talking to you about it now, because in the written down version of your story and the language that you use, it's sort of erased of emotion a lot of the time. It's as if it seemed to me reading it that you didn't want to indulge or allow yourself to sort of fall into all the emotion that I imagine it would churn up. Do you think is that a fair thing to say about it?
It is fair. And I was striving for accuracy above all else. And it wasn't so much that I didn't trust the memories of heightened emotion or the heightened emotion that I was feeling at the moment of writing it, but what was primary to the experience was just the strangeness. And so I wanted to find a way to capture those continual surprises, you know, what plasma tastes like when it's injected into your heart, because you can taste it immediately. For some reason, my apheresis nurse already knew that wintergreen candy was the one flavor that neutralized it enough on the tongue so that you didn't actually taste the plasma as it was pumped into you for 4 consecutive hours. The language, it started out rather clinical, and then I found myself needing to erase any insertions of my emotional responses in order to communicate that better.
And you're also a poet. You've published, I think, 2 collections of poetry to this point. And anyone reading the book will be immediately struck by the layout of the writing. We have some very short 1 or 2 page chapters with titles like Intimacy and The Cheerleader. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that way of laying out the book? It gave me, reading it, a sort of a sense of fragmentation, and I wondered if that was what you were trying to convey.
Trying. I wasn't, and I'm still not used to writing long pieces of prose. Well, I went to poetry school in the 90s, right after college, and sort of, you know, studied verse and studied the short forms. The 1 to 2 page summary of an experience is, I think, just the way that I ideally write and think. This is a section from toward the end of the book where I take stock of the length of time that's been occupied by my disease. The section's called When. How long was I sick? I got the tube pulled from my heart in May 1996. I recovered from my last relapse in November 1999. I recovered from my last severe depression in March 2004. In May 2004, to treat my more or less constant steroid-induced hypomania, I stopped taking olanzapine, which I'd taken for 5 years, and began taking quetiapine fumarate. And this may sound silly or arbitrary or vain, but after I traded olanzapine for quetiapine, I lost 25 pounds in 6 weeks. And those 25 pounds, which I'd been carrying since I'd first gone on steroids in 1995, was fat I couldn't burn off with exercise or by restricting my food intake. It was from the drugs. Once that 9-year-old fat was gone, I looked healthy, even to myself. I ran and ran. I got lean and strong. I was 30 years old, and most of the women I knew were fatter and curvier than they'd been as college students, and I'd thought for the past 9 years that that had happened to me. That I'd taken on the shape of the adult woman my genes had programmed me to become. It was a joyful and confusing time, 2004. I'd become accustomed to being one shape, and suddenly I was a different shape. My gait changed. I became lighter on my feet. I had to buy all new clothes. I became furiously happy. I ran a lot and drank a lot. In 2004, I ran 3 miles for the first time since college, and even though I am even now still taking quetiapine to treat the hypomania, I've integrated the drug's side effects into my life. Also in 2004, I made a mistake in the midst of an unstable euphoria, and in 2005 I took my last drink in penance. after the requisite horror of the first 6 weeks, the first 6 months, the first sober dates, the first sober sex, the first sober year, sobriety made me feel better than I'd ever felt. I say 2004 is the year I got better, because it's the year the biggest problem in my life changed from CIDP to drinking, and that's a separate problem. That's why, even though my last CIDP relapse was last year, I say I was sick for 9 years.
Have you, I mean, presumably you have considered the possibility that somebody with the same diagnosis as you will pick up your book or be given your book. Do you think it would be helpful?
It did actually help me. There was a very different kind of book written by Joseph Heller, who's the author of Catch-22 and other novels. He co-wrote it with his friend, Speed Vogel, not a writer, and they alternated chapters. You know, Joseph Heller would write one about how Mario Puzo visited him and sat in his wheelchair and said he was so envious because now Joe Heller would have an excuse not to have to do anything that he never wanted to do again.
And he had
the same diagnosis. Heller did, not Puzo. It was mostly just a great story about famous writers spending time together in a hospital and bringing expensive foods in and whipping them up and putting them into Joe Heller's feeding tube. and as self-serious as this sounds, I did want to write a book that would bring comfort to people. And wanting to be accurate and not wanting to be sentimental were part and parcel of that project.
Sarah Manguzzo, Two Kinds of Decay is published by Granta. Robert, Sarah said something really interesting there. She said, I remember feeling I was the 21-year-old hero of my own narrative, so I practiced being heroic. Now, you've written a book about your recovery from a stroke, My Year Off. Did you feel heroic at all?
Now, she said a lot of things which struck me very powerfully, and I think that's certainly one of them. I think what happens is you cross into this world which you've never been into before. You go into a new world, which is very adjacent to our own world now. And you're very aware of this strangeness, and you're very aware, if you're a writer, of the extraordinary, really privilege of being in this strange place. And you find it very exhilarating, and you're totally gripped by it. It's completely compelling. And as a patient, you're the star of the show. Everyone comes in, everyone wants to know what your story is. And so, of course, you act up to being the star. It's quite tiring, actually. The whole process, if you're alert to it, and I found her account absolutely ripped, brought back tons of stuff, you're strangely very alive, even though you may be very, very seriously sick, and you're taking notes in your head, you're observing everything. Everything that happens seems to be happening for the first time. It's very vivid, but you're in this strange place, which is like half a heartbeat away from reality, real life, ordinary life. And you know, I was immobilized, but I think she was obviously very, very sick. And my illness lasted for 3 months, 3 or 4 months, and then I made a slow recovery. So it's quite different. I had no pain. The blood thing sounds truly ghastly.
But it's interesting that what you say about being in a place that people haven't been to before, which presumably is partly why it is so interesting to us as readers. Sarah, there have been an awful lot of books dealing with various sorts of illness recently, haven't there?
Yes, it seems to be a real thing in publishing at the minute. And I suppose the explanation for that being that so many people are ill. But as you say, Robert, it's this adjacent world that we don't, as well, people we don't visit very often. And so for those people who are ill, it's important to know that other people have been there before, I suppose.
The other thing you discover is you've discovered that the world is very unwell. Yeah. Everyone has. I mean, I listen to stories, or I used to a lot, all the time. People would say my aunt, my mother, my brother, my lover, you know. Unwellness is all around us, and when we're fit, we don't really notice it. And so when you become ill, you become the recipient, become like a lightning conductor, lightning rod for all this unhappiness and unwellness. Now, so I think the publishers are tuning into a world of unwellness, which
absolutely, recognizing that there's
slightly
huge
underneath
market.
The surface. Interestingly, I tweeted that this podcast was going to be about illness, and I was Twitter bombed by fans of Nassim Mary Jaffrey, who's written an autobiographical novel called The State of Me about living with ME. From the tone of the tweets, they came from very different parts of the world. They crossed over between fans and friends. And I wondered whether that's part of the readership. These people become your friends in the stories. And there are so many of them, Sarah, that you could divide them into genres, couldn't you? And we're not going to deal with mental illness in this particular one, because we think that that actually could have one of its own.
But some of my favourite recent ones are... Hilary Mantel is somebody who has struggled with ill health throughout her adult life and has written about it as brilliantly as she writes about everything. Her memoir is a book called Giving Up the Ghost, and that deals really in depth with her experience of endometriosis and how that affected her life. And then she's recently, just in the last year, published an e-book called Ink in the Blood, which is about the serious illness that she underwent around last summer that she's sort of still recovering from.
Which we carried an extract from in The Guardian. And I found fascinating about it was that she brought up that the circus clown that appears in Beyond Black, which is in a way her most depressive novel, and there he was again in her hallucinations in this terribly distressed state.
Yes, tapping into sort of the darkest parts of her mind, I suppose.
Yeah.
But then we've mentioned Tim Parks's novel Teach Us to Sit Still so many times on this podcast now that he should be paying us royalties, but it is absolutely brilliant. But I think, you know, one of my favourites is actually a book from a long, long time ago. In fact, it's not really a book, it's a long essay, Virginia Woolf's essay on being ill, which I think kind of perfectly captures the sort of alien, isolated state of illness.
The other big arrival in this area is Joe Shapcott, of course, whose On Mutability was about dealing with cancer. Robert, there have been a few out of the Observer, actually, haven't there? I mean, Ruth Picardy's Before I Say Goodbye, based on her columns, incredibly touching.
And John Diamond's book.
John Diamond's book, yes.
I'm trying to think of others.
Because Cowards Get Cancer Too. Wonderful. I love that title. I've always loved that title. Which all seemed to come out in the late 1990s.
And that falls into the genre I thought you were going to mention, misery. When the misery memoir sort of was a very popular genre, not quite so popular now, it certainly was in the late 90s, it was very popular. And cancer, obviously, is, again, everyone knows someone who's had cancer. These are guidebooks to everyday life in some ways.
Sarah, read us a couple of the Twitter contributions.
Yes, we have from Twitter. I always feel slightly ludicrous reading these because the names only really work on the computer screen. But Ian Plays Music says, you better mention The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Ah, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
That's a great book.
Yeah, and that is a great piece of literature, isn't it? It's Jean-Dominique Bauby. It
brings up all kinds of interesting questions. Did he write it?
It's his account of living with locked-in syndrome, for anybody who doesn't know it, where he could only communicate by blinking his eyelashes.
And it's very, very good, but there is a question as to whether he actually did blink his way through it or whether it was written but ghosted for him by one of his associates. There are many of course, he's now dead, sadly. And the movie of it, scripted by Ronald Harwood, is terrific because it really gets the flavour of the book. Mm-hmm. And when I read that book, it was only a year or two after I'd come out of hospital, I found it brought back a lot of stuff, which was quite painful, but it's a marvellous book and really great, actually.
Then we've got Squidita writes, one of the best books about illness is Patient, The True Story of a Rare Illness by Ben Watt. Who's Ben Watt, Sarah?
He was a member of the band Everything But the Girl, and in 1992 he contracted a rare life-threatening illness that completely baffled his doctors and required months of hospital treatment and operations, and the book is the story of his fight for survival and the effect that it had on him and his nearest and dearest.
I think the other thing these books are is they are books from a war zone. I mean, we don't have wars anymore. We do have, obviously, we're at war, but there was a period, came back to the publishing side, when there were a lot of Second World War memoirs, First World War memoirs, books about the Vietnam War. That isn't the case anymore, quite the same way. And I think these medical books are like our war zone books for people who want that kind of buzz. Mm-hmm. I think there's an element of that going on.
This actually brings us on to my next point very well, which is I was actually wondering when I was writing this and thinking about it whether it was a modern phenomenon. But Beth's pen reminded me of Betty McDonald's 1940s book, The Plague and I, so it goes right back. But actually it goes back much further than that, doesn't it? Because it goes all the way back to Montaigne's description of his kidney stones.
And Pepys.
And Pepys, yes.
Donne, I mean, the great English classic writer on illness is Donne. Essays on emergent occasions, which are very powerful, very strange and rather haunting. Mm-hmm. More like poems, really like prose poems about mortality, all about himself.
Mm. And then we've got Alphonse Daudet's In the Land of Pain, which actually I think Julian Barnes translated, didn't he? And he was dying of syphilis, so that's an account of a disease that we don't actually die of now. And both that and the Daudet and the Montaigne were actually written as journals. And in the case of the Montaigne, it wasn't actually made into a book until 200 years after his death, which I find rather intriguing. Anyway, we're just going to move on now and listen in to the book club. It's becoming increasingly clear that people love getting together to talk about books, and book clubs have become an important part of the social landscape, as we all know. I myself belong to one. But researchers are now discovering that actually getting together to read out loud might have measurable therapeutic effects. The Reader Organisation is a library-based movement which makes that possible. It claims increased confidence, fewer trips to the doctor, getting a job. All these things have happened to many of the people in our library-based groups. Let's hear it for libraries. Ties in nicely with our libraries campaign. But, oh yeah, you might say, sounds like a funding application. Hang on. Our reporter, Richard Lee, went out to find out for himself from one reader group in North London.
You know, Mother, he said, when he was alone with her at night, she's no idea of money. She's so wessel-brained. When she's paid, she'll suddenly buy such rot as Marol Glacé. And then I have to buy her season ticket and her extras, even her underclothing. And she wants to get married. And I think myself.
The book group, which meets in a back room at Crouch End's Hornsey Library, began in September 2009. The regular members all talk about their love of books, but this is no ordinary book group. The reading group at Hornsey Library doesn't just meet up to discuss books, they read them aloud to each other as well.
Married as soon as I can. Very well, my boy. If you will, you will, and there's no stopping you. But I tell you, I can't sleep when I think about it.
I'm Tammy, and I come here, well, I've got ME, and so I can't do much, so I just come for the second half, because for me it's quite good to be read to, and I like the discussion. It's a very friendly group. My favourite is doing poems and short stories, which to start with we did all the time. So I actually come later because we do poems. I haven't really got the brain cells to do the long books.
What do I get out of it? Well, not so much reading the book, because I've read the book, but the companionship and the caring for each other and the way Paul democratically organises the whole thing so that we all have a chance to read and to discuss and all kinds of issues that one wouldn't expect from just reading a book have arisen, like relationships between women and men, relationships with men and their mothers. There was a discussion about what book should we read, so we decided on Sons and Lovers, and that has been very fruitful for me.
But then does one ever know how to deal with, you know, if you've had the misfortune to have to deal with a number of deaths, I'm not saying, does one ever get used to it in that sense?
I think so too.
I
think young people react to the first time somebody they know well or close to dies is the greatest impact.
Yeah.
That's not in your ambit when you're very young.
No, that's right.
I found as a child, I'm not thinking specifically of death, but any major trauma, you're sort of feeding off the feelings of the significant adults around you. You're watching your mum, you're watching your dad. And I remember whenever my mother cried, it didn't matter what it was. If she cried, I cried, because that's what you know, you're feeding off their emotions, almost learning how to react. It's almost like a learned behaviour, some of it.
Yes.
I mean, you have your own feelings too, but I think especially when you're a very young child, you're watching the adults a lot.
Paul Higgins, the group's leader, says that the literary enthusiasts who come to Hornsey Library find that reading aloud to each other helps them in many ways.
For example, I was just hearing one of the group members who's been coming from the beginning describe the fact that she now happily reads aloud. For the first 6 months, she didn't read at all. It has the effect on the fact that they go off and do other things together. So for me, it's not just what happens in the group. It creates community, which I think is very important. And they are actually quite isolated. Most people in the group live alone.
The Reader Organisation doesn't just run groups for literary enthusiasts, though, does it?
No, we run groups in all sorts of settings, hospitals, GP practices, day centres. For example, myself, I work in a disabled resource centre where people
have a wide-ranging disabilities. Some of them are cognitive, and intellectually they are able to participate. Some people have learning difficulties, and they're all in the same group. And the amazing thing about this model is that it can work and capture the imaginations of people who have very diverse challenges or very few challenges, all sharing together and all enjoying the same literature. We also work in mental health settings. For example, I was speaking to a worker here in London who works in St. George's Psychiatric Rehabilitation Unit in Islington, and she told me that a resident there, Kate, who has quite long-term and significant mental health challenges, that she finds coming to the group weekly allows her the possibility of, because she's hearing a story, it allows her to concentrate on something, which then helps her to manage the intrusive voices that come into her head. And for her, that is a very significant benefit of coming to the group. I've worked on closed wards. Recently, I was working in Edgware Community Hospital, where after one session, a woman who previously I'd been talking to the corridor and appeared quite delusional, was actually able to talk and share her opinions about a number of poems that we read. And at the end of the session, 1 hour later, said, "I feel much calmer and less." This was very thought provoking. Thank you.
The effects of reading on the brain are an active area of medical research. At the University of Liverpool, Professor Philip Davis has been examining how reading Shakespeare changes brain activity.
We need to be able to show that this is the most powerful use of language, and it has strong activating relationships to the human brain. But because of experimental needs, we have to take a very specific part of Shakespeare. And indeed, when we carry out these experiments by means either of putting electrodes on the scalp or putting people through fMRI tunnels, we need something that is Shakespeare light or Shakespeare dilute. Because if you give people whole lines of Shakespeare, too much is happening at the same time for this very sophisticated equipment actually to register the effects. So we isolated one phenomenon, which I'll explain to you. And the phenomenon is called either word class conversion, or better still, functional shift. Now, this is a particular tool that Shakespeare uses to animate the brain. You take a particular word which is known as essentially as a noun, say the word God. And in Coriolanus, Shakespeare says, not "this old man made a god of me," but "this old man godded me." That word godded had never appeared in the language before, and with minimal change of shape, it is a functional shift from the noun god to the verb godded.
I was wondering what kind of effect you see on one of your subjects' brains when this happens.
Enormous peaks. So here's two examples. See which one you prefer. You said, "I was not to go there alone, but you would accompany me." You said, "I was not to go there alone, but you would companion me." Now, which of those do you prefer?
No, companion is much the fresher for that effect.
It's much the fresher. That's absolutely right. The easier one, the one that makes the brain go simply straightforwardly left to right, is accompany. But Shakespeare will often use a word such as companion. It's a noun, but it's turned into a verb. You would companion me. What people are experiencing at that moment is the recognition that this is grammatically odd, and yet semantically they recognize it. And there is an enormous wave of excitement hitting that target word, companion. And why is that target word good? Because it just doesn't mean you go along with somebody, but you act as their friend, their companion. There is more emotional release. It raises levels of attention so that the brain is primed to look for more excitement, more difficulty thereafter.
And
what we think is that this is a small image of raised consciousness as a result of those emotional prompts.
And is there any kind of clinical evidence for this kind of effect on people with problems?
That's going to be part of the other sort of research that the Reader Organisation has been carrying on. That's to do with dementia patients, people who are suffering from depression, drug addiction, looked after children who have not been read to, all of those things, there are behavioral changes. We are in the middle of a world epidemic in relation to depression. And that world epidemic is costing millions in terms of drugs. If the reading therapy can be as effective as we believe it can, enlivening people up and creating small communities where people are sharing this dynamic effect, then not only will the arts be shown as central to the well-being of human beings, but they will also be cost-effective. And that's to say, poetry, not Prozac.
Poetry, not Prozac. I like that. Richard Lee there talking to Crouch End Reading Group. Many thanks to them for allowing us in. Now, it seems that it's not just any old reading that works, but crucially high quality literature.
I think what's going on is it's reading and writing. I mean, when you write something, you make sense of it. When you read something, you make sense of it. And what this does therapeutically is to make sense of chaos. When you're ill, you're in a chaotic situation. And reading and writing, I mean, these books, the readings, they're doing the same thing, which is they're providing some kind of balm of simplicity to the turbulent
mind.
And
allowing people to put a shape on it.
Yeah. I think the Shakespeare thing is very interesting, but in a way it's rhetoric, isn't it? It's the power of rhetoric.
Yeah. Well, let's just move on now, because we've talked quite a lot about that, and turn to fiction and the novels that can actually make us comfort us in hard times. I remember well the curious effect of reading Little Women as a child. I rather wanted to be Beth and dying, but actually I was always going to be a Jo. I was always going to be rather bossy and survivor. Sarah and Robert, two points here. There are writers who can make you feel better and the ones that write well about illness. So let's start with the ones that can make you feel better. And let's start with a couple of tweeters, Sarah, just to set the discussion up.
Sonia Barrington says that funny books work best, so it all depends on what you find funny. Terry Pratchett works wonders for me when I'm ill, so that's sort of one possible route that you can
Robert, go. I imagine Woodhouse is your choice, well, having being not, a, being well, a rough, someone who's written a book about P.G. Woodhouse.
People always say Woodhouse cheers you up, and it's true. I think it's true. It does cheer you up, because it's comforting, and funny is good.
Sarah, you got into trouble when you mentioned Updike's rabbit books.
Yeah, you see, it's really interesting that you say that, Robert, because actually for me it's the opposite. I find funny books when I'm feeling ill are actually quite depressing. So in times when I've been feeling ill, the ones that I've sort of gone back to are John Updike's rabbit tetralogy. Well, it's sort of what you said, that thing about the high quality literature, and rabbit is nothing if not high quality, I think, anyway. And also there's something very reassuring about the bleakness that he brings to everything. The lucidity of it on the one hand and the bleakness on the other. And I guess it's just a form of escapism. Everything that we're looking for in books is to escape, and that's the way that I find it easiest to escape.
Also, I think you reread. I reread a lot of Austen when I was unwell. I mean, it sounds rather highfalutin, but I just felt comforted by the fact I knew it was beautifully written. It's familiar. But I think bleak is good too. I think bleak works very well. And if you're feeling pretty bleak, it's quite helpful.
Yes, maybe it's just a sort of, it's finding people who are worse off than you. Perhaps that's what the
But there are some writers. There's another issue here, which is about the writers who write well about illness. And then maybe not necessarily the things that one wants to read when one's ill, but however they have found a niche. And the Victorians were particularly good at it, weren't they,
Robert?
They were
very familiar with illness, Dickens.
All those Dickens invalids.
Well, yeah, for me, it was interesting you mentioning Little Women, actually, because when I think about the books that I've read that have been about illness, it's children's books that come most readily to mind. And if you think back to the seminal texts of childhood, so many of them, Little Women, Heidi, Secret Garden, What Katie Did Next, in which there's this really long section about a little girl suffering from scarlet fever, they're all built around the idea of illness. Kind of appealing on the one hand, because like you said before, Robert, it's about being the centre of attention. You're the star of the show if you're the ill person. But also terrifying, so it has that kind of double pull, I think.
I remember reading Gone with the Wind when I was about 13, and I had flu, and I vividly remember my back up against a radiator and feverishly engaging with it. And I still, whenever I think of it, I feel a bit feverish ever since. Again, let's go back to our tweeters, and one person, Jenny Sue, said you've got to mention Pollyanna, surely. Quite right. Yeah. Pollyanna. Who other? Tell us about Pollyanna.
She goes and tends to... Sorry, this is really fishing back through my memory of Pollyanna, which I didn't really love very much as a child.
It was 1913, that. It was Eleanor H. Porter, wasn't it? It's very old, much older than I thought.
Yes, it is. It's an old book. And she goes and lives with her aunt and uncle, I believe, and goes and tends to a sick woman and brings her jelly and tries to cheer her up with this thing that really stuck in my craw as a child, the being glad game, I think it was called.
Yeah, being glad. Yeah. And it starts off with them for her getting a pair of crutches from the Christmas barrel, doesn't it? And yes. Her dad says, oh, don't worry, thank God you don't need them. That's a really, yeah. really bad test.
It's the real sort of grim end of sick little.
Anyway, I want to take us out of children's books and back into the classics. Katie Welsh says, Wilkie Collins writes well about disability, which takes us back to the Victorians. Even if his characters are defined by it, they're still fully realised and complex. Oh, and moving forward, Susan Sontag's Illness as Metaphor is incredible.
That's a very important book, which I read when I was in hospital. And then, of course, there's William Starron, Depression and Illness, Darkness Visible.
Yes.
Comes to mind.
Now, Polly Sampson joined, the novelist, joined the Twitter thread and said she doesn't think anyone's bettered William Styron on depression.
He's very good on depression. Very short. It's very intense. It's very disabling to read, but it's very powerful.
And a couple of people mentioned the Russians. Now, we always think of Russians as a bit, well, a bit depressing in some ways, don't we? For all the right reasons, of course. Chinoiserie talked about Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich and said it brilliantly describes the experience of illness of both sick and surrounding healthy people, which is a point, isn't it? Mm. And Cyclist name-checks Chekhov's short story Ward Number 6, which actually, thanks for that, I looked it out on the internet and it is absolutely fantastic. Have either of you read that?
I don't know that
no.
one.
No, you see, there's so much of it.
It's in Cancer Ward.
Yes.
3 volumes.
So now, Sarah, we can't leave poetry out of this, can we?
No.
Your particular favourite.
I guess probably the two titans of sick poetry, ill poetry, sick verse, what do you want to call it, would be perhaps Keats.
Keats, When I Have Fears That I May Cease to Be. That's another of my teenage yeah. absolute passions.
And then yeah. the other one is Emily Dickinson, whose refrain from her poetry, After Great Pain and Formal Feeling Comes, is, I think, one of the most sort of resonant and beautiful phrases about illness ever. And not just illness, but the idea that after illness there's a recovery, there's a space and a calmness at the end of it. And I think, yeah, she's somebody we have to really consider. But then Elizabeth Barrett Browning as well is great on the poetry of illness.
Is she? I was rereading Elizabeth Barrett Browning recently. It's an awful lot of old tosh, it seems to me.
And Sylvia Plath, we can't leave her out.
No, of course. And SPL Shop mentions The Poetry Cure, which is edited by Julia Darling and Cynthia Fuller. And of course, Julia Darling died very prematurely,
yeah,
didn't she?
Of cancer, but wrote a lot about... Can you call it the act of being ill? I guess you can't because it's such a passive state. The state of being ill. Mm. She wrote brilliantly on it.
Mm. So lots and lots of stuff to read there. And you can actually find quite a lot of it on the web, particularly things like the Chekhov. I would recommend you go and do some scrolling around because it really does reward it. And that's it from us today. Do join us next week. It's Valentine's Day week. And so we'll be looking at a surprising history of the Lonely Hearts ad. In the meantime, Sarah, what have we got coming up?
Well, on the website, we'll be picking up on the Valentine's Day theme with a competition on Monday to win a copy of Ovid's The Art of Love. And if you're listening to this on Friday, you can come online over the weekend as well and catch up with our top 10 love poems nominated by the poet John Stammers, and of course add your own to the list beneath. Meanwhile, in Saturday's Guardian Review, Alex Clark looks at whether standards of editing are dropping in publishing, as several people, including you, I think, Claire, have suggested recently. And several writers also give us their views on that, including Jeanette Winterson, Blake Morrison and Diana Atthill. And again, obviously, we'll have a comment thread on that, so please join in and we may pick it up in a future podcast. In The Observer this week, the new review on Sunday takes up another of the week's debates, whether it is in bad taste or not for the Booker to run a Best of Beryl Bainbridge prize. A.N. Wilson is going to debate that with you, I think.
We're keeping it in the family.
We've just done it, yes.
And also, Rachel Cook interviews the novelist Nicole Krauss.
And I'm afraid that's about it, so goodbye for this week from Sarah, Robert, me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.